It's 8:18. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, Park City Schools started this week, and so did efforts to pull out 5 unhealthy ingredients from the food served at our district school cafeterias this year. Gina New and Kate Geegan are both nutritionists and members of the Child Nutrition Task Force that helped set this change in motion. They join me now in studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So this has been a multi-year effort, first taken on by EATS, the Eat Awesome Things at Schools group, and then pulling together this task force to eventually eliminate 15 unhealthy substances in school food. So what were you able to pull off the menus this year, Gina?
Well, this year we started with our first 5. So it's a 3-year mission, 5 ingredients each year for the next 3 years. The first 5 include trans fats, high fructose corn syrup, MSG, sulfites and sulfates, and sucrose, which is Splenda.
All right. Well, I just heard an off-air collective sigh from all wine drinkers. What's wrong with sulfites?
Well, they're used as preservatives in food, and for some individuals, they can cause allergy-related symptoms.
All right. So are these considered maybe the low-hanging fruit of bad ingredients? Is that easy to start with, these?
It is, exactly. We wanted to start off with things that we could easily remove and to not create too much of a palate change for our children, and things that we can easily source. Sourcing is obviously a big part of this. A lot of big brands and restaurants as well are removing these ingredients. Trans fats, obviously one that's already on its way out and in most cases completely out.
Yeah, and that's the hydrogenated oils, the Criscos of the world, is that?
Correct.
Okay. So what's still to come off?
Artificial colors, we're working on that. I think a lot of parents don't realize that in Europe, many artificial colors actually carry a warning label around potential disruptive behavior in kids. It was struck down in the U.S. There's still a big initiative to try to have that labeling in the U.S., but there is a fair amount of evidence around that, which is why it made our list.
Is that like the red and the blues?
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
Those brilliant colored candies in the vending machine or what have you. Hormones and antibiotics in meat, poultry, livestock products. That's a pricier change, a sourcing, but
much more sourcing.
On-ramping it this year with the quick wins, with the 5 that we could achieve, but that's certainly a big one in this community as well as in the literature. Bleached flour is another one. Just can't we up-level the flour to be unbleached? Then we could even go to whole grains. You know, as nutritionists, Gina and I, we'd love to see more whole grain flour, but unbleached flour. And you would be amazed at how pervasive it is in
all sorts
of bread products.
Mm-hmm. Coatings, breaded foods and croutons, things like that. So, again, it's much more of a sourcing issue than it is us wanting it out. It's much harder to find the products that are the cleaner products.
Right. Yeah, so what do you mean by sourcing? Just what's available then?
Right, exactly. The school district, of course, they buy as a co-op, not as individuals. We're not buying this just as Park City School District. We're buying this as Utah State Child Nutrition.
So all big part of one big order, I guess, is what you're...
Yeah, and one of the things, Leslie, I think that we're hoping both as EATS and as the school district is this is kind of a chicken and egg. A lot of people don't realize that the school lunch, unlike, say, the chemistry program, school lunch has to be self-sufficient financially, which means we need buy-in from all students in the district to go and send their kids to buy school lunch to be profitable, that then creates the budget that allows us to purchase no hormone, no antibiotic. We can't just, with a magic wand, instantly upgrade everything and then have people buy in. So that's also why we're doing baby steps to really generate the on-ramp of enthusiasm, excitement, and where we can get those quick wins so parents have confidence who may want to be sending their kids. I mean, I speak as a parent as well. I have a 9 and 11-year-old, and I send them a couple days a week for school lunch because we all need to be part of that mission. If we want our school lunch to be better, we need to get involved with our dollars.
And that's some of the reason that parents aren't sending their kid to school lunch, because
yes,
of the concern of some of the ingredients that we're processing the foods with.
And we're not just talking about food here either. We're also talking about equipment in our kitchens. We're looking at a 30-year history of reheating food in kitchens across the nation. We are a processed food nation, not just not just in our schools, but in our homes as well. So we need to go back to being able to have the equipment in the kitchen. So we're our school district invested in that. We also need to train our staff so they'll be able to prepare the food again. And then we have to change the palates of the children. As we know with the Healthy Lunch Act that Michelle Obama implemented, there was a lot of blowback because the children aren't used to eating these foods yet. So I believe our partnership with Eats is fantastic because we're going to allow the children to taste these foods, and then they get to decide which of these foods they want to see as regular menu items. Because we're looking at many, as Kate was saying, it's the chicken egg. Which one will come first? But we have to take the steps one way or another.
Well, tell me a little bit more about the taste testing that you'll be doing. Is that happening at school?
Yeah, we've actually been doing it for several years. And I can tell you, Gina and I have both gone in to taste test. I'd invite anyone listening, connect with your local school and go in. We now, actually, my company is sponsoring an app that the kids will now be able to judge how they like it. But we were very low tech before with bulletin boards and stickers. And the goal was just taste it. It's okay if you don't like it. Just try it. Tell us what you think. And that's that first step, that first hurdle. It takes 30 to 50 exposures to a fruit or a vegetable for a lot of kids before they're going to like it. And so our goal really is familiarity, just knowing that these things exist, that they're out there. What do they actually look like in nature? And then, okay, how do you like it? How may you prepare it at home? But it's amazing what a little tomato sauce, Leslie, will do to get kids to like any vegetable I've found.
Interesting. Yes. I mean, can you do these? Do you do these testings like blind? Because that's sometimes a lot of it's just they look at it and they think they don't like it. But if they were maybe just to perhaps smell it or taste it without seeing it, that maybe they would buy into it faster.
Well, I found it's amazing when you tell a child what the nutritional benefits are of a food, they all of a sudden are more interested in it. I was amazed. The taste tests are one of my favorite things to do. And to go into the class and to go into the lunchroom and have the child taste a food, and then later you hear them say, this was good for me because of this. But we're excited about the new Adventure Bites program that Eats is doing with the school district because it's a community collaborative effort. We had restaurants from all around Park City develop the recipes that the kids are then going to try. It's not just a single ingredient anymore. It's an entire meal that they'll get to try and then decide.
So they're using all of their senses then to try new food.
Exactly. And it will bring some familiarity. Deer Valley Chili is going to be making an appearance in the schools. I think a lot of parents don't realize, too, every school this year now has a salad bar, and all the salad dressings are made from scratch this year. So the transformation is happening. And it's just thank you for letting us come and raise some awareness about this so that parents know. And I'd invite, go have lunch with your kid. Go in and see what's happening in the lunchroom.
So when we talk about salad dressing, I mean, again, that can be lots of dangerous stuff in that. What are we using?
Well, that was when I was looking through the ingredient list of the things that we were interested in pulling out, I found the majority of them were in salad dressings and condiments. The little things that we're putting in, not just all in all, our ingredients in the school district were very good and are very good. You could build a healthy lunch. There are those little things and, of course, those outsourcings that we were looking at. And so Deer Valley came in and they helped us design our natural buffet salad bars that the kids all now have in every one of our schools. And also they're creating their first The first item that the kids are going to taste test is Deer Valley lasagna, followed up very shortly by avocado salsa. They're both appeared all the time in Deer Valley.
And it is amazing, Leslie, a lot of the ingredients on the 15 to clean are put there to make shipping and processing and storing food a lot easier. Once you move to scratch cooking back on site, those ingredients disappear by themselves. We're not adding artificial colors or artificial sweeteners.
So the district has put nearly $200,000 to making this happen. Is that just for 1 year? And what are you going to use that money for? I mean, is it to buy the kitchen equipment, or is it just for the additional staff time, or all of the above?
It's all of the above. The school district, I'm so very pleased with how much they've invested to make this work. They have invested in equipment for our kitchens, extra time for the staff to cook. It takes longer to cook from scratch than it does to reheat something. It also, they invested in cleaner products. These cost more money. And they are investing in more marketing, obviously getting the public aware and involved.
So is that financial commitment in the years to come, over the next 3 years at least?
Yes, if this program proves itself sustainable, they're going to continue to invest in it.
Okay. What about all the sugary drinks at the high school? Are those off limits? Or?
Do you want my personal opinion as a dietitian and a mom, or the policy? That's one of the real hot button issues nationally, for sure. It goes, you know, is sports drinks. We have a huge active community here, and you may need a carbohydrate replacement if you're going to ski in the afternoon or go mountain biking for 3 hours. But I can tell you nationally, it's a real challenge because, well, is diet soda with zero added sugar something that should be allowed? Water's sweetened with zero calorie sweeteners. Well, is that good? Because we're hydrating and we're encouraging. Flavored milks is a huge issue nationally because it's nutrient dense. And, oh, does a little bit of sugar make it more acceptable then? And, hey, we're getting them to drink a serving of milk. So, I'm not personally familiar with what the legislation is right now at the high school, but I can tell you I'm on the district wellness committee, which is rewriting the rules for the district right now. Mm-hmm. That will have to be approved by the school board, but it's a federal mandate that every school district needs a wellness policy that guides the decisions, everything from vending machines to parties to bake sales and things like that. And we are trying to align with the national standards, which try to get a lot of that stuff out.
Yeah. It seemed at one point there was like an agreement between the school district and a manufacturer of sugar drinks, you know, and that's the only product that could be in that school. So I don't know if that still exists, but
I think they've worked very hard to eliminate the number of sugary drinks, and they're limited by how much sugar they can serve in the schools. They're limited on the fat, the sugar. They have a quota they have to meet on the number of servings of vegetables and fruits and whole grains. And I know that our child nutrition director and all of our nutrition staff work very hard to make sure that the food and the items that they're serving are the best they can be. And I'll definitely want to say I'd love to thank our child nutrition staff for all the efforts that they've put forward to make this work and all the effort they've put forward in the past as well.
All right. So you're inviting parents to come have lunch with their kid maybe one day.
Have lunch with your kids. Check it out. Get involved with the taste test and just see what's cooking at your local school, because it's changing this year and it's the beginning of great things to come.
Absolutely. It's going to be the best. And we've already had 80 volunteers sign up to help with Adventure Bites. The community is coming out of the woodwork to help with all of this and make it a success.
All right. Where's the best place to go to get more information?
Park City School District's website, pcschools.us.
Yep.
Okay. Gina and Kate, thanks for coming in this morning.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
You.
8:33 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour on KPCW. The Park City Council met last night for their regularly scheduled meeting. On the agenda was the Woodside Park development. One of the issues discussed in the studio with an update, Park City Council member Tim Henney. Good morning, Tim.
Hi, Leslie.
So you, the Elliott Work Group
well,
showed...
Leslie, first of all,
yes.
Congratulations.
Oh, thanks,
number
Tim.
One. On your Rotary Award. That's fantastic, seeing your name with that list of people. It's like it's meant to be there from the beginning, so congratulations on that. And also on the fundraiser. You concluded last night, although the live auction goes till 6 o'clock tonight.
That's
and then
the right.
Back Alley Bash that starts at 5.
Yep.
Yay.
Hope everybody will come out and celebrate with
Sorry
us.
Sorry for interrupting.
That's okay.
I do
let's
do
get
that.
Back. Let's get back to Bonanza Park. The Elliott Work Group showed the plans for the Bonanza East project. This is between Kearns, Bonanza, and Munchkin, asking the council for some insight and direction. The issue was before the Park City Planning Commission earlier in the week. That just seems a really quick turnaround. How come?
No,
it's...
they didn't come to us last night with Bonanza.
Oh,
no,
I mean,
they came
with Woodside.
Woodside.
Yes, excuse
yeah, it's
me.
A,
yes.
That's a different area.
Yes.
So Woodside is just north of the library field.
Correct.
And it's the old fire station site.
So let's talk about some of the concern there with the accessory apartments.
Yep.
And the recommended plan was
sure.
option 3. Why is that a particular concern?
You mean why was option 3
yes.
or why are the accessory apartments
Well,
the
I think
concern?
That was the concern of option 3.
Well, there was
three.
A lot of discussion about the accessory apartments. We're all in favor of the idea of accessory apartments, not only when we're building units, and I was thrilled to see that concept incorporated into this plan, but also hopefully we can start to incentivize an accessory apartments in other neighborhoods where they're appropriate, say, you know, Old Park Meadows, Prospector area, and if we could get an accessory apartment by incentivizing or granting, say, and this is hypothetical, just as an example, $100,000 to a homeowner to help them install an accessory apartment that would then house one to two people. That would help the homeowner with affordability. It would also be a very cost-effective way to create housing in the form of accessory apartment. Now, accessory apartments on this particular project, the concern is how do we keep them accessory apartments and not in the future have them become storage units, gear areas, or second or third bedrooms for the townhouse which they are attached to and the accessory lockout apartment for. They would be owned by the person who owns the deed-restricted townhouse, and that person or that family, the owner, would then be able to rent them out, thus helping their affordability equation and creating that accessory unit as an affordable housing extra units. So we go from 12 primary units, I'm sorry, from 8 primary units to 12 with the 4 accessory apartments.
Okay. So back to what you said just a little bit earlier about having other homeowners do this with their own home. That was something you and I have talked about before, and you were like, no, I don't think that's a good idea.
No, I said I thought it was a good idea, and we were discussing it. I think it's a great idea, quite honestly. I think you get good bang for the buck. It's just a matter of we have HOA concerns. We have HOA barriers. We have CC&R barriers in certain neighborhoods. We have resistance in other neighborhoods, but there are definitely neighborhoods where accessory apartments, I believe personally, would be very appropriate. I bring it up in every conversation that we have about affordable housing, that very idea. Hmm. I think it's a great idea, and I am told by Ann Laurent and Rhoda Stauffer that it is in process. They're looking at the possibility with Bruce Erickson from planning, and they're going to come back to us with future recommendations on how we may be able to do that.
Okay, back to Woodside Park here. The underground parking mentioned several times, trying to fix the issue of having to back out onto Park Avenue. What are some of the issues with that? Just affordability?
Well, if you look at the scheme of the third option, then the second and third option were very similar, and they don't have parking at each of the units. So we've stripped the parking away and made it a communal parking, which is on that parcel that is just to the north of the fire station that we just recently acquired. So that's a vacant lot. It's a flat lot, and the idea is to park the project's requirement, parking obligation, at that site, and then the people would then walk to their homes. So they don't have garages, which means there's no pulling in and out, no curb cuts, no backing out into Park Avenue, which we think is a great idea. It also starts to put the focus on a less automobile-centric project, which we think is a great idea. And it also brings up the issue of, you know, why can't we do more density? This is something that was brought forward by Becca. She was like, well, how come we can't have a couple more accessory apartments? Why can't we have a little more density? And the response was, in this zone, there's a parking requirement, and this is all the parking we can put on that site. Now, the cost of undergrounding, what you gain for what you pay, makes this whole thing become, the subsidy would be astronomical. And because of the configuration, it's such a small footprint of the parking site, we were told that just the logistics of getting the ingress and egress, the ramp in and out, it does not allow for it, basically. It's more engineering and physics.
Hmm. All right. You also heard from Councilmember Becca Gerber recommending targeting plans toward young couples or people with small families. Is this the biggest need?
Well, we're trying to assess the need. The biggest need? Look, we've got a huge need across the board. So it's at this point, I don't feel personally that we have to specifically call out the greatest need. Our need from one end of the spectrum to the other is so far off the charts that anything we do to address any need within the parameters of that spectrum is going to help. So we should be starting. We can assess, you know, the acute needs as we go, and that's what we've been promised by staff. They are doing work on that. Now, we're targeting this project from 60% of the area median income to 100%. It's a mixed type and a mixed income mix. From 60% down, you start to run into people who cannot get qualified through traditional means to purchase a property anyway. So they're going to run into problems at the bank. So We felt, well, we feel, staff feels that 60% is a good benchmark to try to use as our lower end for affordable housing. You also get into seasonal and workforce for our largest employers once you go down below 60%. And we're trying to delineate and define whose responsibility that end of the housing spectrum rests with. Is that the city's obligation or is that the employer's obligation? We're not super clear on that yet, and I asked for clarity on that last night going forward because I think that's critical for the community to understand.
Can you put some numbers on that? I mean, what does that 60% of the average median income mean, equal?
And this is off of a chart that we were presented with last night. This is household income, not individual, but a two-person household at 60% of the AMI is $47,221. 100% is 78,701. And then if you go up to, you know, three, four, and five-person households, those numbers increase. I asked why, because it seems to me you could have a one-person earner in a one or in a two-person household, just like you could have in a five-person household. But it really has to do with as you progress and you age and you have children, you move through your earning cycle and you tend to earn a little bit more money. And this is purely statistical data. It doesn't take into account anything else. So looking at two-person households, that's how the numbers break down.
Yeah. We talked with Andy Bierman a couple of weeks ago, and he was telling us that he and his wife are considering putting their shares of Treasure Mountain Inn on the market. And I had asked him, I go, this sounds like it could be an affordable house. I mean, they've got, what, studio and one-bedroom apartments there. They've got underground parking. They've got a bar. They've got a restaurant. They've got community space. Is that something that the city would even be interested in looking at?
Well, my guess, and it is just a guess because I haven't heard anything from staff. I mean, I'd say two things. I'm sure that staff, it's occurred to staff just like you and I that maybe it might be appropriate for affordable housing. What we hear a lot of times when we dig in and start to look is that the free market has priced a lot of these properties beyond the ability to convert them to affordable housing because anything that we do in affordable housing requires a subsidy. And the subsidy required for something like that property at that location with the people who might be interested in from the free market to turn it into a boutique hotel and do a complete renovation, I think it prices it out of the affordable realm.
So when we look at the rest of that acreage there, Woodside Park just being under a half acre is my guess. I mean, what else are we thinking about that? And why aren't we master planning the entire parcel at once?
We are. That's a parallel process, and the Elliott Work Group is working on that as well. And across the street, the zone changes, and that was brought up last night. We're really constrained with the HR, which is the historic residential zone, on the side of Woodside that we're working with this particular project. But you go across the other side of Woodside, and you're into a different zone. The heights go from 27 feet up to 35 feet, so you have a little bit of height there. You also have a different topography, which would allow possibly for an easier underground parking configuration. So there are a lot of different components that come into play, but that's across the street where the senior center is. You know, we've had discussions about what do we do with the senior center. We want to house the seniors, number one. That's the primary focus, so we have to have a plan for that. And number two, it's then what do we do with that structure? Do we move it? Do we reorient it on the site? Do we tear it down? It's you know, it's the old, I think, Echo train station that was hauled into Park City from Echo a long, long time ago. Some people who are purist would say, well, because it was hauled in from somewhere else, it's not really historic to Park City. I look at it and I think, you know, it's got some potential. It's a pretty cool looking building. It certainly fits within the historic context of our community.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention from the meeting last night?
No.
Okay. Hey, Tim, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Leslie.
It's 8:45. Good morning. Well, as we've reported, the Park City Planning Commission praised the work of the architect and developer now working for the Bonanza Park development, but had a number of concerns about what's actually being presented in the studio with a recap of Wednesday's Planning Commission meeting. I have Commissioner Steve Joyce. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning.
So you didn't mince words when you said you don't buy this. It's a walking violation on many levels. What's so wrong with what's being presented?
Oh, you have to be careful about what we were looking at. We were looking at one chart on one page. And that's when they do a study called a site suitability study, which is how much you could possibly build in a particular plat, they basically had taken all the possible space that they could if they got all the building exceptions and really didn't even build a real complex. It's actually a problem in our code where we don't specify how to do a correct site suitability study. So developers kind of want to show the biggest number they can. So it's just not very realistic. And to their credit, they did it the way we've seen it before. It's just wrong.
So we need things fixed.
Yeah, we need to be more specific in the land management code. It's not that the land management code says do it the way they did it. It's that it just says do it kind of, you know, we want to see the maximum volume that you could build, and it doesn't really go into what they mean by really build.
So what do we know what the maximum density on this is, and are they meeting it with what's being proposed?
Well, that's really the biggest issue I think we have is, for people who don't know, this is right there at the corner of Kearns and Bonanza, and it's about 5 acres out of the 100 acres in the Bonanza Park area. And this is the first real redevelopment that we're seeing. They've brought us a plan, which is a nice plan. It looks good and everything, but it's really packed a tremendous amount of density into it beyond what would the just standard code would allow. So an example is there's a 100-foot setback on 248 because it's the frontage protection zone, but we can allow them to come up to 30 feet from the road. Well, they built all their plans. They originally started with 30 feet. Now they've backed it to 60 feet. But we still really don't have a good answer for why it's not the 100 feet that it would be as kind of a default. They've also got we use the term underparked, which at some level is good as we start trying to push people to mass transit. But they've kind of got less parking and more building. They've got out of the 7 buildings, I think, 3 of them were 4 stories tall in their proposal, and one of them was 5 stories tall. Now, one of the things they did that was nice going from our first meeting with them to our second is they actually pushed that height back away from the road and kind of tucked it back in the middle so that it's not nearly as intrusive and visible. But it's still an exception to the code. And so the code says you can build 3 stories in the GC district. They've got 4 and 5. And again, this is part where we haven't gotten into those discussions yet, but they've got a tremendous, tremendous amount of density in there.
What does this development want to be? I mean, is it market housing? Is it workforce housing? Is it community commercial? Is it a second Main Street with high-end clothing boutiques and galleries? A new home for the Kimball Arts Center? Do we know?
We're not sure. Unfortunately, some of the sad part, if you look at the general plan, which is what we're doing, this is in what we call a pre-MPD stage. What we're trying to do is make sure that the plan that they're bringing is consistent with the general plan and its guidelines. And the whole focus for Bonanza Park is this idea of live, work, play. So we have real people who really live here in town, and they can go to work in the same area and play in the same area. And that's, we asked a lot of questions. This is kind of early in the cycle to know, you know, exactly what kind of stores there would be and things like that. But it's a mix of residential and commercial and office space. They had originally proposed to put a hotel there, and we pushed back pretty hard on that immediately. And thankfully, the hotel is gone from the plan now.
So is it consistent with the general plan, what you saw?
It's on track. We still have some questions to really kind of get into more things. One of the things is in the GC district, our GC zone, nightly rentals is an allowed use. And so they've got a number, their proposal for spaces are that most of them are smaller. They're not these big, you know, 4,000 square foot condos like we see in these projects. A lot of the things in there are 800 square feet, 1,200 square feet, that kind of thing. There's a couple of big ones in their proposal, so that kind of fits. But if they all end up becoming, you know, nightly rentals or second homes, then that doesn't really meet the whole live, work, play piece. And so we've got another meeting. I think we've scheduled it for October that we're going to try to drill into that some more.
Yeah. What about the any mention of the event center? I mean, at one point we were talking about a new venue for Sundance Film Festival.
There is nothing like that in the plans at all. there, I think the only thing that would even come kind of close to it is something more like the little shell down at New Park, where there's a plaza area that they've proposed, and they have a little stage with a little shell. So they would have a place where you could have somebody like Mountain Town Music, you know, come in and have some shows and things like that there. But it's nothing big.
All right. So when we talk about, you know, maximum height being three stories under the GC code, general commercial, how is it that they can get that 4 to 5? I mean, what is it that they have to provide to get that increased density?
So there's really two options as part of the master planning thing. One is additional open space, which their current plan doesn't have. And the other would be additional affordable housing, which the plan currently doesn't have. They have affordable housing. They don't have any level of additional affordable housing that would justify this kind of thing. And again, this is early to really be having those discussions. They'll start when we really get into the real MPD process. But, yeah, you can't just have 4 or 5 because. In fact, if you look at that whole form-based code thing, the biggest pushback we got from people on form-based code was the idea that you would have 4 or 5-story buildings, even though you had to justify them with things like affordable housing. People still pushed back really hard. So I think that's going to be the biggest challenge for the applicant here.
Okay. Comes back October 26th.
That sounds right.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. Any specific direction that you gave them?
Yeah, we asked for some more information, really kind of along the lines that you asked for, of, you know, more about the content of what's in there and what the makeup would be and whether we really will have people. It's one thing to have office space and commercial space and people living, but it has to be the same people or you haven't fixed anything. So that's the challenge.
Okay. Steve, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks. Good morning.
Well, as we've reported, the U.S. Ski and Snowboard Association and Solitude Mountain Resort have announced new events for the 2019 World Championships being held here in Utah. In the studio with details, I have Deer Valley Solitude Marketing Director Colleen Reardon, along with Callum Clark. He's the Vice President of Events for U.S. Ski and Snowboard Association. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning, Leslie.
So were these events not going to be held as part of the championships, or they were going to be held as somewhere else? I mean, the fact that we're adding them.
Yes, so they're always part of the official program. When we go out into bid, we know what we're obligated to do. The trick then is to develop an event plan that works for the community and works for the overall event. So that was the process of us, after being awarded the event, is securing the competition venues. Mm-hmm. Some are no-brainers. You know, we have the world's best mogul venue in the world, in Deer Valley, Aerials as well. Half Pipe also is a no-brainer. Ski and Stumble Cross, that took a little while for us to secure.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we went to the ski team hoping that we could involve Solitude because it is our newest resort, and we would it's got the perfect venue. And we just really wanted to gain the exposure over there, as well as support the athletes that live in the Salt Lake area. You know, there's not been this type of event in Big and Little Cottonwood Canyon, we don't think, ever.
I don't think so. I think it's the first time ever.
Well, and that was one of my questions, too, because, of course, all of the Olympic events were kind of forbidden from going up the Little and Big Cottonwood Canyon. So do you have some challenges ahead of you in terms of making that venue work?
I think we have an amazing opportunity. The competition venue is outstanding. Mm. Remembering at the 2002 Olympic Games, Ski and Stumble Cross was not a part of that Olympic program. So that's the first piece. From a competition venue, it's in great shape. The management under the leadership of the Deer Valley crew and the Solitude crew that we've met has been very, very impressive. We need to step through some logistical issues, but remembering that a World Championships is not an Olympic Games, so we have some room to move that probably wasn't available to us in 2002.
Yeah, and I'd agree. You know, with Carrie Westberg, our senior event manager, she'll be leading the charge over there along with Nate Lee and Kim Mayhew. But the venue is spectacular. Take the Apex chair up. It's about a third. The start is about a third of the way down Wall Street, and then it finishes on Main Street, which ends in the Solitude Village. I mean, so spectator friendly. It's going to be fabulous, and it's a learning curve for us over there. We're going kind of from 0 to 100. We didn't have the opportunity to do a regional event or a nationals or anything like that. But we're really confident in our staff at both resorts that we'll get this done in a really great fashion.
Yeah. So what has Deer Valley learned, I mean, from hosting, you know, the Olympic course and, of course, the World Cup champion? I mean, it's a ton of work, but it's also worth it in the long run.
Absolutely worth it. From the first perspective is from the athlete perspective. Yesterday, sitting at our press conference and listening to those three athletes talk about how important it is for them to compete on, you know, home turf. And then to these kids that are coming up through the pipeline, to be able to go watch their heroes compete, I mean, it gives me the chills. It honestly does. Listening to them speak was so meaningful to us. It was like we've made the right decision. And secondly, they're a lot of work, but they're also, I would say, from a staff perspective at the World Cup, it's the one thing we do that every department touches and comes together, and everyone's so proud of the work that we do. So we're going to bring that to Solitude.
So this, you're going to actually have a test event this January, so you're going to have that figured out. Yeah.
That's right. We have a lot of work to do. I'd just like to say I'm humbled and proud to have the Solitude and Deer Valley as a partner. Being able to speak to the athlete-centric way that they run events, it makes it. This is the reason why they are the best in the world. Why the world loves to come to these events. We have a Grand Prix coming up this January. It's a ski cross, a snowball cross, and team snowball cross. All these events are in the World Championships, and this is our opportunity to run a great event, but this is our test event. This is our opportunity to test the venues, understand the structures, and really get our teeth into the details in preparation for 2019.
Okay, and I mean, we certainly know giant slalom downhill, yeah. Those kind of races, moguls and stuff. The cross races, they're the crazy four start, just bonsai to the bottom.
I know. If you remembered in the 70s, they made shows about this as, hey, look at these crazy skiers and how it's an Olympic sport. It's so spectacular. You have four great athletes pulling out of the start, shoulder to shoulder, and there's bumps and berms. And the most wonderful thing about this sport is you know immediately who's won. The person who crosses the finish line first, that's the winner. And it's exciting right down to that moment the athlete crosses the line, which is so cool.
Yeah, should be a lot of fun. Again, details to be worked out. I guess you'll be busy figuring out how you get people up there. I mean, you've got a big old parking lot at the bottom, right?
Sure.
So it could just be shuttle buses. Is
part
that the
of our
idea?
Planning process with, I don't know if it'll be UTA, but we'll definitely encourage carpooling and have a transportation plan in place. And then going to work with TK and Callum after they come back from FIST meetings to hopefully we'll get approval on a final schedule and get that announced.
That's right. The preliminary schedule is January 21 and 22. So we are tied in close to the X Games. And we're looking forward to a great event. But between now and then, we have a lot of planning.
Yeah, we do.
Okay. Anything else you two wanted to add? It?
No.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for coming in.
Bye.
Again, that's Colleen Reardon and Callum Clark. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW.